Martha Tippett. And she was born in 1892, so she was relatively old when we moved here, but still pretty active. And she and I just became very fast friends. She had no family here, and I remember having a surprise 85th birthday party for her, where she was absolutely flipped out. We didn't know many of the neighbors, but they all came, and the house was packed.
Wow.
To honor her.
Right.
Because she was so respected. And as she became more frail and stuff, I became really more involved in helping her and meeting her needs.
What kind of stuff did you do for her?
Oh, well, when she needed to be driven somewhere, I took her. I would take her. She liked to go visit old friends that would be out of town, you know, an hour and a half away,
right.
Like Warrenton. Places like that, I would take her because she was scared to drive there. And I met wonderful people that she knew. She had friends sort of all ages, and I was very much included in that. She could tell stories that were just beautifully told. So the more I worked with her and the more I sort of volunteered, and I began to look because Jacqueline was going to go off to college in 82, and I thought, I really need something to bite my teeth into. And I went up to School of Public Health and talked to them about a doctorate in nutrition.
Right.
I hadn't kept up with journals, you know, all these things. A lot of things had changed in these intervening
right.
years. And once I talked to them, I realized, I'm never going back in math. That's not really what I want to do anymore. What I've been doing is basically volunteer work, and I haven't mentioned everything, but a great deal of it was with older people and programs that related to them. So I went to see the people in social work, and it was a very different program in 82. There were very few older people coming back to school. It did not have the number of students that we have now. I'd never taken the GREs. I'd never been required to. So I talked to them, and they very strongly suggested that I apply and take the GREs. So I spent some time preparing myself, trying to remember the math I'd forgotten and all these other things, and getting ready for the GREs. I got one of those barons or something and spent hours going through it. And then took the GREs with my knees trembling so much it rattled the desk during the whole exam. And did okay, much to my amazement. I decided somebody was kind. And got into the school, and went to school between 82 and 84, and was older than most of my professors. I was in my middle 40s.
Right.
So I was older than most of my professors, and when I think back, I think how terrible I was. I remember in classrooms challenging professors about, you know, theories and real world and all this stuff in a way that probably wasn't too kind. And when I finished, what I really wanted to do, because I'd been involved in the founding of hospice in North Carolina. I'd been on the committee that started hospice in the late 70s, and then on the board of Triangle Hospice, which was the local hospice. And it was an organization that I dearly loved, because I really think people need control over their lives and choices, and a very different model from the medical model, from the acute right. medical model, where families are included as part of the standard of care. And where volunteers are involved and so forth in a team.
What drew you to that in the first place? Like,
you know, I don't know. One of my friends was involved in the committee, and she called me and said, you know, could you come to the meeting? And immediately after that, I was captured.
Right.
It just seemed like I'd come home. And when I worked at the Mass General, I don't particularly recall, except I can remember a few people who you would call me in the room, older people, and would beg me to go read their chart to see if they were dying, because they wouldn't tell people.
Right.
They'd want to know, do I have cancer? Am I dying? You know, these questions that I knew if I did it, I'd be fired.
Right.
I would have been in big trouble. So I saw a number of instances like that. Another thing I remember was being on rounds with a doctor, and this was a fairly well-known person who had a brain tumor, and who just... There weren't many machines then.
Right.
I remember the first kidney machine. And I'll tell you a story about that if you'd like it.
Sure.
But the doctor just walked in and unplugged everything. You know, you didn't go through all these things that families go through. And I thought, you know, how kind he is to do that.
Right.
To the person and to help the family. The family weren't there. But he just said that he's had enough, and so has his family, and unplugged whatever was plugged in. I don't remember what it was now. It wasn't ventilators and all that, because they didn't exist. But I think those kind of issues have always been... I'm a person who likes to have control.
Right.
Not knowing what boundaries are and all that has always frightened me, probably the way I grew up. But anyway, so I think that was something that was very strongly of my interest. So, now I've lost my train of thought as to why I went to the school.
You were just, you're telling me what you were doing.
But hospice was, really a new concept then.
Right.
As was Alzheimer's. And I'll tell you a story about that in Duke, too, in my school. I went to the school, and they're basically, I said I really want to work with older people. And I think I was one of the few students who ever said that to them. They really didn't have very much of a program. And in many ways, they were very tolerant of me because they sort of tried to give me as much as I could. So my first year, I spent at Duke, two days a week, in the Alzheimer's unit. And most of my professors had never heard of Alzheimer's disease in 83. Right. So I used to come back to school and, talk about this in the classroom and so forth. And many of the teachers were fascinated. We were doing education work because Duke at that point was starting its program. And they gave me a lot of responsibility. I was older and I was, and it was a real pleasure to work with many of the people that I worked there. And then the second year I said to them that I wanted to work at hospice. So I had to resign from the board in order to be a student there. So I worked at hospice and did a number of things. And again, my professors knew nothing about hospice, so I was bringing that back to the school. That was sort of a new concept for them, too, and the role of social work in that. And one of the things I did while I was a student was that I was disturbed that it was thought of as a middle-class white organization. That's who used it, the educated white. And I said, given black families and value structures and all, this is an organization that really ought to be serving these people. And Durham was part of the catchment area with Orange, and at one time it had been Wake too, but it was too big an area, so Wake broke off. So what I did when I was a student, I had the luxury of doing this, was spend about 3 months really visiting with all the black leaders in Durham and talking to them about hospice and trying to educate them. And practically every Sunday morning, the black churches were very kind to me and that they would let me come in and do a presentation to their congregation.
Oh, wow.
So we turned the Durham Hospice into the most integrated hospice probably in the country.
Wow.
To make it more reflect the population. And to this day, board people and patients, etc., are very well represented in the hospice. So those are sort of my experiences other than classrooms when I was a student.
Right.
And when I left, I thought I'll never, I wanted to go into the community to work because I really like hands-on clinical work.
Right.
Never occurred to me that I would get a phone call 6 months later from the school asking me to come back. I was working in home health in Durham County in basically the minority community, which I loved.
What does home health do?
Home health delivers care to people who are acutely ill under the Medicare reimbursement model, and again, it's nurses and social workers and PT, etc. You may have a stroke and be home, and you put the staff in to help, and I would be in with resources and that sort of thing, depending on the situation. And it's a short-term, not a long-term care. So I got a phone call from a school saying that they were interested in organizing something in geriatrics on the campus. Would I be willing to come back part-time? And I wasn't sure. I thought about it, and I said, well, yes, I'd come and talk to them. So I did, and at that time, there was a person at the school of public health who's no longer there who got a grant, and the grant was to pull together the whole campus to do some education in gerontology across the health sciences and social work. So I came back, and I coordinated that program for our school. And meantime, I left home health, and I was at also in hospice. I was working two jobs part-time. It wound up being like two jobs.
Right.
But I didn't want to leave hospice because I loved it. I mean, I just, you know, it was just like, it just fit something that I needed. And
what did hospice satisfy for you compared to, like, being
well, I always felt like that I could, you cut through all the facade that's there from anyone who's dying. They have very important things. And so many things don't matter anymore.
Right.
Really important things are the things you want. And if you could help people get what they needed, and families, relationships repaired, people being able to say, I love you, to each other.
Right.
Providing the kind of atmosphere and support and love that was needed, then you really felt, and I always felt I left getting much more out of any patient family I ever worked with than I gave them. And I think even today, you know, there'll be waves of thoughts when things will happen, and I'll think back to a patient those years back and realize the impact they had or the thought processes that affected me in working with them. And looking at who I am as a person. So anyway, hospice was then pushing me, saying, we want you here all the time. At that time, we had 6 or 7 patients. So it really wasn't a lot. But it was slowly growing. Right. You know, it had to be accepted. It was a new concept. And the university was saying to me, we want you full time too. So I was really torn about what I would do. And then probably one of the most life-changing things happened in my life that ever happened. My brother was a professor at University of Rhode Island and at Brown. He was an animal scientist and head of science, workaholic. Married to a lovely young woman who in 86 was 45, and they had 2 children. And Marcia had a master's, but she stayed home. She was very quiet, probably lacked confidence in herself, played the piano beautifully, and was a marvelous gardener. Had thought that she would go back to work when the younger daughter finished high school, when the daughter finished high school. And this is January of 86. And she and Glenn, she ran 5 miles a day. Didn't carry 1 ounce of weight that she shouldn't. And I think was appalled at me that I had let myself gain weight. But she and my brother were shopping. It was a Saturday morning. And she developed a terrible headache. And it kept getting worse in the grocery store. So he took her to the little hospital, which was nearby, a couple miles away. They had gotten a CAT scan a week before, which is amazing. And took her there. They scanned her, and she was having a massive cerebral aneurysm. Ambulances went blaring to Brown with her, which was 35 miles away, Rhode Island Hospital. And my brother went to find the 2 kids, and they did hours of surgery. And she came out on total life support. And the summer before that, Marcia was her last trip here. Had been here. She read a lot. She was very close to my older daughter, Jacqueline. She had gone to school at Wesleyan and Yale and would spend a lot of time with my brother and his wife in Rhode Island. And she and Marcia were particularly close. And she came out in total life support. But anyway, when she was here the last time, she had been doing a lot of reading, and of course, because of Jacqueline's interest in Soviet things, she had done a lot of reading of some of the Soviet books, and we were discussing them, and some of the fiction, etc. And she had always sort of had this obsession with Caroline Quinlan. And she said to me that day, she and I were alone, we were in the kitchen, and she said to me, you know, they had taken Caroline Quinlan off the ventilator.
Right.
They had left the gastrostomy tube in.
My advisor just wrote a book on, my other advisor, Peter Filene, he just wrote a book on the right to die, and so I've just been reading this
story. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
About my sister-in-law?
No, about Karen Ann Quinlan.
Yeah, Karen Ann Quinlan. But anyway, Marcia had been reading that, and she said to me, you know, Florence, I've thought a lot about this, she said, and she looked me straight in the eye, and she said to me, we talked about hospice and that sort of thing. She said, if that ever happened to me, you wouldn't let them be that cruel to me. You would stop feeding me, wouldn't you? You would see that that happened. And I said, of course, she's perfectly healthy. Think nothing of making a commitment like that. Not realizing that less than 6 months later, I would be facing that. And so her mother was living, her father was dead, and she had a sister. And she came out on the ventilator, and after about 6 weeks, we decided to ask them to take her off the ventilator. Children agreed. We spent a lot of time with the neurologist. And they took her off the ventilator, and she stabilized. She had enough brainstem function to stabilize. She was still in intensive care at Brown, still getting physical therapy to prevent contractions. She developed an infection. They had to go back in and put a shunt in for drainage. And when they did, they removed the bone fragments, and her head collapsed into her eyebrow. So you looked at her, and it was hard to look at her.
Oh, wow.
And after about 7 or 8 months, Brown said to my brother, "We really are sorry about this, but we can't keep her here in intensive care any longer. I mean, this is getting..." He had Blue Cross Blue Shield of the state because of being a faculty person, and of course he was at Brown, and the people knew him. You're going to have to transfer her. And she needed so much care, of course. She had to be suctioned, had to be turned every hour, all these things. A nursing home wouldn't take her. So I read the policy and reread the policy, and so did Glenn. And there was no way that we could read that the policy was going to cover anything of her medical care after she left there. So they transferred her to Cranston General Hospital, which is a big general hospital. And it's on a big campus, sort of like Dix, in that the prison was there, there was this hospital, it was mental health, etc. It was 5 floors, and it looked out over Point Judith, which is her favorite place on the ocean with the lighthouse. And they transferred her there. she continued at the same. We had people look at her. Everyone agreed there was nothing there. There was nothing there but brainstem that had kept her autonomic functions going. And after about a year, we talked again, and we decided that we would ask them to remove the gastrostomy tube. And that was something that just was not being, had not been done.
Right.
So my brother spoke with the physician. He said he agreed. He thought it was perfectly appropriate. There was no hope for recovery, but that we would have to talk to the hospital administrator. So my brother made an appointment, and when the family went to talk to the hospital administrator, the attorney general was there of the state. And he said to us that not only could we not remove the gastrostomy tube, but we couldn't take her out of the hospital. Meantime, it's clicking at over 500 a day. So my brother said to him, first he said to him, "We'll move her to another place." He said, "You can't move her because your intent is to commit murder. And if you move her and remove the tube, as a chief law enforcement here, I'm going to charge you with first-degree homicide. You, the members of the family, and the doctor in the facility that does it." So my brother said to him, "Well, I think we're going to have to sue you then," and left. So in order to sue the state and the attorney general, the hospital administrator, we of course had to go to federal court. And no family had ever gone to federal court before. There had been some in state, like the Quinlan and the Job and Brophy. There had been 4 or 5 smatterings in state court. So we found a young lawyer. She was 36, Linda McDonald, who had never tried a major case, but whose husband, when they were in law school, had gotten cancer. And they had made a decision when to stop the treatment. Of course, it wasn't removing him for anything. But she understood the issues. She was far enough down the road from the bereavement, we felt, that she was a balanced person, very bright. So we decided to go with her rather than a big hotshot attorney. And Linda did a marvelous job. She's now chair of the Bar Ethics Committee and really has a national reputation in the area now. But anyway, we went to court. And one of the things we attempted to do was to get the Catholic Church, because Rhode Island's 98% Catholic, to take a stand, and couldn't get them to. There was no response. So we filed the case, and 2 or 3 months later, and the judge that we drew was Francis Boyle. And Francis Boyle was the Right to Life attorney, was the attorney for the Right to Lifers before he became a federal judge. So it was kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
But anyway, then eventually the bishop Genevieve of the Catholic Church actually called a press conference on a Saturday and against Rome and so forth supported us. Said he had investigated it thoroughly and that we were right. That there was a certain time when death was, you know, what one would reasonably expect. I don't think those are his words, but that's basically what he meant. And we then asked the National Hospice to enter a friend of the court, which they refused because removing food and hydration was too radical for them.
Right.
Which has always been a disappointment to me because of my involvement with hospice. Right. The Bar Association was supporting us quietly, but in the background, so was the medical. The Episcopal Church supported us. Very few groups would support us. It was like you were hanging in a jar by yourself. So the next 2 years we're in court with the all sorts of things happening. With the right to lifers being unmerciful. They picketed, they brought them in by the busloads. They would picket, and when you went in, they yelled murderer at you. After a while, you know, it was making international press. We were all known.
Right.
And I was under more and more pressure because I was flying to Rhode Island on weekends helping my brother, talking to him every day on the phone because he continued teaching. Mm-hmm. We tried to normalize things as much as possible for the children. And the university said to me, you have to make a decision. So I left hospice and came to the university full time because I could not continue to deal with the issues with hospice
right.
professionally and then deal with that personally. So that's when I made the split here, always intending to go back to hospice. And the outcome of the whole thing was that at the end of the year, on Halloween Day in 88, the judge ruled. And he ruled that Marcia's rights under the Constitution were denied her. Many people think that Boyle's decision is the best one that's been made yet in a court case, much better than the Supreme Court, that her rights were denied her. He quotes the Wade Row practically every other page. He said that no healthcare provider has the right, no matter what their discipline, to project their values onto the patient. The patient always decides. If the patient is incapable of deciding, the family decides. And if there's thought to be conflict or not reasonable thoughts on the part of the family on the patient's behalf, that the burden is on the opposite party to prove the interest is not best. Mm-hmm. Well, the Supreme Court reversed that with the Cruzan case. But in any case, it wound up that they gave him 30 days to either apply to the Supreme Court or to, that we could remove her, but if we decided not to remove her, they would have to take the gastrostomy tube out. And so it wound up that the local hospital where she first had her x-ray, CAT scan, took her back and were marvelous. They dealt with the whole staff, on and on and on. And the pickets continued, they moved to the other hospital. And just before she died, she lived 10 days, just before she died, local people started coming down and picketing against the pickets.
Good.
So it was sort of chaotic in a way. There was no violence, but we were nervous there would be. And the hospital provided a place for us to come and go without going through the pickets. And her funeral, we had to have the police cordon off an entire block. And you could only get in if your name were on the list. Because at the Brophy funeral in Massachusetts, they stormed the church. and I felt my brother couldn't deal with that. And the bill was $1 million, just slightly shy. Blue Cross Blue Shield quietly paid Olive Brown with a deductible in all the last hospital with 10 days. And the small hospital and 80% of the Cranston Hospital. And no family had ever sued for giving medical care against will. And I wanted to sue. And my brother said, I've had it after all these years. I can't go any further. So what we did was our lawyer went to the state, and my brother also said to me, the taxpayers of the state will have to pay this. He went to the lawyer, Linda went to the hierarchy and told them that we were going to sue. And it was amazing how quickly the $200,000 became a few thousand.
Right.
So my brother sold some property and was able to pay it.
Wow.
But that's sort of in a nutshell what happened. Those were very hard 3 years.
Sounds horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, drink.
We did what was right. I don't have regrets. I feel like death was a friend, and it was very... we did what we needed. I think we respected and showed probably the greatest love we ever showed her by respecting what her wishes had been.
Right.
But, it left in scars, no question. You think you grew from it, that you're stronger. I like to think I'm a stronger person. I'm a better social worker. That I understand patients and families better because of having had that experience.
Sure.
I still have, and I'm sure you could hear my voice, some intolerance for groups like Right to Lifers. I think they have every right to their opinion, and I'd fight to see they did. But they crossed the line.
Sure.
They didn't respect my value system and my family's value system and Marcia's. That's where it really bothers me. And that's where I hope I'm always sensitive.
Right.
When I work with individuals, that I respect that structure and value and never cross that line. That I'm there to be a resource but not to intervene in a way that's negative for them.
To tell them what to do.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to take a little visit down the hall. I guess one other thing I'd like to tell you is that we were then contacted when they did not jump our case to the Supreme Court. They backed off. The Cruzan family contacted us because they'd gone twice, Supreme Court in Missouri.
Right.
And what they were able to do, our attorney helped and met with them, etc. And they've since become, they're good friends. But they were able to take our case and then jump hers right to the Supreme Court.
Oh, okay. Wow. That's
so, yeah. And so there's a little cadre of people who've gone through these cases now. Armstrong, Quinlan's attorney, came to the trial and supported us along with the family, and so did the Jobes, and so did the attorney from Massachusetts with the Brothies, and Mrs. Brothy's been very supportive, etc. So people have gotten through it, very supportive of people who then face a similar situation,
right.
Which has been very positive.
Well, those cases have become things which people refer back to now all the time in terms of development and how these things have gone.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the classes I teach have our case as referrals in the literature.
Right, right. Yeah. Wow. So did you try to work at the School of Social Work doing all of this?
I did. It gave me structure. I needed diversion with structure, and it was sometimes hard. But I think it would have been a disaster if I hadn't had something that diverted from that. And my brother continued to work. He actually lectured to the day Marcia died because he felt he needed the structure too.
Good.
He said, in the classroom was when he could forget.
Sure. Probably one of the few times.
Yeah.
So what kind of program were you developing at the school at this time?
Well, at that time, we were attempting to develop classes. We were developing classes for students in aging. We were attempting to reach across campus and relate to other schools. I began to make a lot of contacts with medical school and the program on aging, of which I'm a part and have been for years now. At that time, we didn't have the cross with all the students like we have now, the interdisciplinary teams and the very close relationship that has developed over the intervening years. But it was we began to develop structure in that we also developed a class that was taught in the evening so that practitioners could come in and get the classes because they were feeling they didn't have the background in aging, and yet they were working with older people. Nothing like demographics now. I mean, it was much less then. It's continued. And North Carolina now is number 3 in the country of in-migration of older retired adults.
Yes,
only Arizona and Florida are more. So it's really, along with the people who live here who are aging in place, many people feel that in 5 years if it continues, will be number 1. I just had a phone call from the president of the United Fund up in Hendersonville. They've done a little needs study, and much to their shock, have found that 25% of the population is over 25, over 65.
That's amazing.
And they're saying, we're not spending our funds to build stronger aging programs. They want a university to help them. But which is one of the things we ought to be doing, is a lot of outreach in the community and helping as much as we can. And it's one of the things that we do in the program in aging as examples with students and teaching for about 8 years now, we've been going as part of the AHEC program and community. We go up to Northampton County and do a clinic, work with the practitioners there, see older people, see people in the community, sometimes in the home and in the nursing home. We've actually been working with them since the nursing home opened. It's a community, private, nonprofit nursing home, which is very unusual these days.
What's the community of Northampton like?
Jackson.
Okay.
It's one of the poorest counties in the state. It's more minorities than non-minorities, very rural, wonderful people. A little town, I think, has 200 people or something, which is the biggest town. It's fairly near Roanoke Rapids, up in that way, up near Virginia.
So it's a team of you that goes?
Yes. Mark Williams, the geriatrician, Ann Flash, the nurse practitioner, Sherry Rosamond, the physical therapist, Sue Coppola, PT, and myself, the social workers go up. We fly up on the AHEC planes. And then we also have a plane for students. So we take a team of students with us. I have a social work student, there'll be a medical student, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll have students often join us from ECU and most always from Campbell University.
Okay.
So that it's a big teaching clinic as well as help for the practitioners. Very helpful for us. And then we can also put students up there in the summer in teams to work on issues with them because it's too far for them to take classes and come back and forth. And they do things like needs assessment. One group developed Meals on Wheels, a whole variety of projects over the years. And then for 5 years, I think it is, we've been going to Scotland Neck, which is in Halifax County. And that's in our community hospital. Isn't that a marvelous name? The community got together because they were so far from facilities and raised the money through grants and private donations and built a small hospital. It's a nursing home and rest home and acute care beds.
And it
serves Scotland Neck,
okay.
Which is a little town in which the cars still park in the middle of the street. You know, there are no parking meters on there.
Right.
And I think the restaurant there is a Hardee's, if I'm not mistaken. Wow. I'm not sure there's another one there. It's very small. Lovely people again. And so, again, we have student teams that go with us. And the others join us, which is, again, a wonderful outreach. And then the other place we go is McCain Prison. And that's a prison down in Hope County, south towards South Carolina. And we go there every other month. And this is the old TB hospital, built in the early 1900s. And North Carolina has taken all of its older sick prisoners and put them there, which is going to be one of the looming issues in gerontology in this country. It's because we're not letting prisoners leave prison. And many of these people have committed very serious crimes, others not so much. But they're old and sick. And it's costing the state approximately $67,000 a year to keep one of these people in prison because Medicare doesn't pay. It's out of your tax money that pays for all their care, whether it's dental, psychological, physical, whatever. And if they were to go into the community in a nursing home or a rest home, it would be half that. So I think we need to rethink policies. And it's a national problem.
Right.
And North Carolina is so far ahead of the others, they're terrified, many of these older prisoners, that they'll get sent to what they call the big house, which is central prison where the young people are, because they get so abused.
The elderly?
Oh, yeah. They're terrified of these younger prisoners. So let me turn the heat up. You're probably cold.
Just a tad.
Yeah. And then we also have telemedicine, which is two-way television, and it's hooked into these rural areas, like the nursing home, our community hospital we go to, and so forth, so that we often can, the team can see patients in between our visits.
Right.
And when we started it, people said, well, these older frail, people won't adjust to this. No problem at all.
Really?
After 2 or 3 minutes, they're absolutely comfortable, and so are their family members. And I do a fair amount of telemedicine.
How often do you do?
It varies. Sometimes I do more than one session a week, in that I do some teaching for nursing assistants and other people over, we just do classes over this. I often see older people in the nursing home that the social worker will want me to see. Sometimes because with their families, because there may be strife. Sometimes because the person may be depressed. But many times what I do is reminiscing with them. And I tape it and give it to them a tape.
So you do your own sort of oral histories?
Yeah, it's sort of like helping them deal with what's happening in their lives and look back and feel good about themselves. And give them the tape. And I have so many notes from families after these people have died that I didn't know that about Dad. You know, I didn't know Mom did that. And it's this wonderful treasure to have kind of thing. So that's a great deal of fun. And it's often they're sort of depressed. And it helps them energize themselves and feel better about themselves. And
so you do this just with your patients?
Yeah, with people in the nursing homes. Wow. And then one of the other things I've done, which I need to do more of, and which I found fascinating, is that many of the people in these nursing homes, and particularly minorities, do not want to sign what's called advance directives, living wills and that sort of thing, because they don't trust the healthcare system. And you can understand, given what's happened here with segregation and all that. So what I've been doing is taking very small groups of 5 or 6 people that the nursing home identifies. Usually among them will be a person who is comfortable with this issue and who's signed living wills or whatever. And I sort of discuss with them, and this gets taped, videotaped, discuss with them about what the laws are in North Carolina about this, and then talk to them about what they want for themselves. So that it gets taped and it's a part of the record.
So that even if
and twice they, this has been used now with people. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to sign anything, but they were willing to talk about it.
Now that's fascinating.
So I'm going to be doing more of that, because I think that's another way to get at capturing what people want.
Is that done much anywhere else in the country?
Well, we've just put a grant into Washington for it, and the people there wanted one of the tapes. And they think no one else in the country has done it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that I was creative. It was just that the nursing homes kept saying to me, you know, these people aren't telling us what we want.
Right.
And everybody was very nervous the first one I did, because they didn't know how people would react to this over telemedicine.
Right.
No problem.
Wow.
So I think that is a wonderful medium to use. And the other thing is, when I have students up there, because the rules of the universities, you have to have certain qualifications to supervise them. So what I did was supervise them every week over telemedicine. And I would see them when I'd go out, but in the interim I use that. And I'm trying to acquaint my students with it. Like next week I'll be running a group, support group, for caregivers out of one of the areas over telemedicine. And I'll take a couple students with me, because I want them to have the experience not only of running the group, and I'll help them out if they get in trouble. They do pretty well. But I want them to be comfortable with telemedicine, because I think it's a way of reaching people that is unique and maybe a wave of the future.
Right.
So that's probably one of the exciting things that I love the most that I'm doing. And the other thing, of course, are my students. We have a master's and doctoral program, and I'm involved with the master's students, and I'm chair of the aging concentration. The first year, our students take a generic set of classes, and the second year, they concentrate in one of 5 areas: gerontology, family and children, mental health, administration, or health. And so I chair, and we're the smallest concentration. The fewer number of students actually go into aging, and that's true whether it's medicine or whatever.
Why is that, do you think?
I think many people don't want to work with older people. They feel there's not a future in it. And with children, there is a future. All sorts of things have been said to me. They've already had a chance. Most of them are grumpy and not very nice, and that they're going to die anyway. And there are all sorts of things. But I try to push them with the demographics. By the year 2000 in this country, we're going to need 60,000 social workers trained in gerontology. And each year, there are about 35,000 students getting masters in social work in this country. And less than 3% of them are choosing aging. And then they leave and they get a job, and it's with older people, and I get these panic phone calls. Tell me how to deal with older people.
What do you tell them?
Well, I usually suggest some books.
Yeah.
And the other thing we're getting ready to do, I just was working a lot on it this morning, is we're going to develop a certificate in gerontology that people can come in and get supplementary.
After the fact.
And I'm trying to find a place in this country that has one. I worked all morning, and all these places that supposedly have them, and when I call, they don't, for a model that we can look at.
Right, right.
I haven't found the model yet in social work.
Right.
So that's one of my projects that I'm going to work on and hopefully come out by next fall by having this certificate available for people who want to come in. And it should be available, actually, for people in other fields who want to come through.
Right.
We'll select some classes across the university, including probably your class on life review. I was looking at that, the description of it, and thinking that should be a choice for people.
Yeah.
But it's whole campus-wide.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, we're thinking of looking at the classes campus-wide,
right,
trying to decide how many hours a person would need, et cetera, in order to qualify for it, and do we need to select specific areas, et cetera. So that's one of the things we're looking at. The one of the other things that I'm doing with my students, which greatly excite me, I'm also expanding the places where they do field practicums. And I'm trying to develop very diverse ones where they don't do the same thing all the time. They may, for example, I have one student right now who's a little older, who's had a fair number of, that's the other thing, that students in aging are older usually.
Right.
So they've had life experiences that have driven them to choose that. But I have one student right now, several years, and she's Monday with me in the geriatric clinic. We run the clinic on Mondays, the same team. We've been together for over 10 years. We do a geriatric clinic for very frail older people.
So this is the same team doctor, the whole?
Yeah, same team, and it's a teaching clinic too. So, except we have more geriatricians seeing patients.
Okay.
It's a busy clinic. So
is that the hospital?
That's the hospital.
Yeah.
So I still do a lot of clinical work.
Wow.
And then phone calls from families and all that in between. But anyway, she's with me on Mondays in the geriatric clinic, and then she goes Wednesdays to Carol Woods. And then on Thursdays, we have a grant from the Hubbard Foundation, which takes medical residents, social work student, pharmacy student, nursing student, and we had to go to Duke to find one, because the nursing school basically is not putting out people in aging.
The nursing school here at UNC.
And PT. And we see patients in the home environment as a team.
Wow.
And it's teaching them to work as a team. And this exciting thing for my student is that she's the coordinator. And usually social worker doesn't take the lead role. But this is a situation where she offers the leadership and does the preliminary work and deals with... And then we discuss, of course, the issues. And it will vary. Sometimes it may be a broken hip, and we talk about the issues with that, and PT will lead us because of, you know, all the exercises and so forth. Sometimes it's a medical problem, sometimes a social problem,
right,
et cetera. It's a great teaching tool, and the students love it.
I would think so. How, I mean, are programs like going into people's homes like that very, you know?
Almost non-existent.
Really?
Yeah, and you learn so much by doing it. So obviously we have to choose patients who are sort of Chapel Hill, Carrboro.
Right, right.
But there are plenty of them. That's not a problem.
And are these patients that can't get themselves to the hospital or don't want to go to the hospital?
They could, probably with Easy Rider or something
like that,
or family members.
Okay.
Wow. And some of these are residents' patients.
Right, right.
But they learn a great deal by going to their house. They see them at the hospital, but going to their house, they learn even more.
Sure.
Person is very different in their home environment.
No, hold on. I'm going to...